All right. Here's our first Intermediates podcast, the Cam Jam. So, Children and Media Cam Jam. I'm Jerry.
I'm Kiara.
My name is Michael.
Chris.
All right. So, we're here today, struggling through our first cast. We're all interested in children and media. Chris is a grad student and also teaches several media classes. I'm a grad student and I teach a couple media classes. And then Mike and Kiara are both deeply interested in communication and media. So we're all here to do kind of an end of the semester wrap up. And maybe I'll just throw it out there. What was the favorite thing you looked at in the children and media class? Had it about 8 months ago, and I'm sure I remember everything.
No, it's all cobwebs. I don't remember any of it, actually. One of the big takeaways I remember from it was the Incredible Hulk study. I don't know if that was specifically your class or a different media class I had, but I always just thought it was interesting how kids at a certain age, was it six or seven, they are more afraid of the Incredible Hulk, and they don't really compare him with Bruce Banner. They're just more afraid of his like visuals and just him going crazy face stuff. And the kids over 6 and 7 were afraid of fire because it was a realistic fear and things that were tangible to them in real life. So I always thought that was an interesting takeaway.
Classic study by Cantor.
Classic.
And Sparks, and then he wrote his book on media, which we use at UConn, and covers that. And it comes up. It's a fun little study.
Yeah, I mean, I can even relate back to my life because I remember when I was younger, like the first real scary experience I have was watching The Leprechaun, because I just remember he just looked so frightening, and like his voice, he had like a weird cackle, and he was just like, "Yeah, keep little children." I don't know whatever he said, but yeah, I was just so, and I obviously saw it before 6 or 7. I was so afraid of that, and then I was afraid of the movie Twister, which I was probably above 6 or 7 for that, or at that age frame, and I remember that movie really freaked me out, so I could relate it back to my life. The style points there.
I think we all have something from our childhood that we kind of remember. For me, it was Star Trek. At the end of Star Trek, the original one, not the Next Generation, at the end of the credits, they showed this one picture of an alien, and I never saw it during the show. It was just at the end of the credits. It was this really freaky-looking alien that just stared at you. And I just remember having nightmares. Can't watch the credits to Star Trek even today. But Sparks in his book actually talks about how he's afraid of mannequins. So
mannequins are frightening. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that Twilight Zone episode where like the mannequins come alive at night and they
I think the that's exactly why he's afraid of them.
Yeah.
He watched that as a young child, and every so often when he goes into a store, a department store, and he sees a mannequin, he kind of takes a step back.
Yeah, you double take a little bit.
Yeah.
Does that move? I don't know.
But, I mean, what about that other movie during the 80s called Mannequin with Kim Cattrall, where she became the love interest of a guy? I mean, that was a comedy.
Oh, is that where she was a mannequin, like, by day or something like that? And then
she
by
was
night,
in a department store. She was a live woman.
It's like the typical awesome 80s movie.
All the elements of comedy except for humor.
Okay.
I liked it. Nailing it. One-liners.
Did you have one that really scared you?
I really liked horror movies as a kid. I loved Chucky. He was my favorite. I would watch Chucky every single day. I had videotapes and I would like rewind and watch it over.
So you weren't a Disney princess like I want to watch Sleeping Beauty or
I loved Chucky so much that I wanted to dress like his wife Tiffany,
the bride,
oh, yeah, and I would put the she in the movie. She does the little birthmark. And I would do that, which is why now growing up, my parents never restricted any television for me, and I only watched grown-up shows. I didn't like cartoons. And now that my father remarried and has younger children, and they're afraid of everything because they restrict heavily, so taking the class made me look back. And when I interviewed my father and I asked him, you know, why are they so different from me, why are they, you know, scared of everything? He's like, oh, well, I let you watch whatever you want. And my sister, you know, she can only watch cartoons.
You think, did you see the first Chucky first, or did you see, like, the comedy first?
Yeah, Child's Play.
So you saw Child's Play first?
Child's Play. And, yeah.
Yeah, so you even
that's
were
one I like. Yeah.
My parents never restricted any of my movie watching, but I was still terrified of Chucky. And the reason I was terrified of Chucky is because Chucky is based off of a childhood 80s doll called My Buddy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one. And so after watching it,
I
was afraid.
I wanted one. After the movie's over, I wanted one. And my father never got one.
Did that affect the sales of the My Buddy? Like, did that?
For horror movie fans, yes. For
the ones
who were afraid of it, probably not.
So it probably stayed the same.
Yeah. It wasn't like
you
that
walk
Elmo
through,
craze.
You walk through an aisle of Toys R Us and you have all these kids screaming, no, Mommy, don't make me.
I knew the chant. The chant to bring Chucky back to life.
You memorize that?
Oh, I would do it at school.
Wow. You were popular.
Clearly it didn't work, though. That's good.
Wow. I was just in Vegas, and they had all these people on the street corners in costumes. So Mickey Mouse, SpongeBob, and it was creepy because they were all knockoffs and dirty, and a lot of them would have like cigarettes and beer in their hands and tip jars out. But it would be Hello Kitty, Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, Hello Kitty, Minnie Mouse, SpongeBob, and then Chucky. They're just random Chuckies, and a couple Star Wars characters were out there. But that was pretty scary. I don't know who was letting their kids go up and take pictures and giving those people money.
Yeah, it's just like.
Covered in dirt.
Mommy, Mickey Mouse is trying to give me cigarettes. Let's walk away.
Yeah, we got assaulted by Elmo in New York. He just like came at us and said, give me your money.
Well, his puppeteers know him a lot of trouble.
Oh, yeah. Right. Maybe that's why. Got to take advantage and use
I was never into scary movies, but what got me was Gremlins was big in the 80s. And I remember my dad and all my uncles were into it. And so if we all got together, somehow it ended up on HBO or whatever. It was funny. Mm. Like, I remember everybody laughing, so I wanted to watch. But there were some parts towards the end. When they turn, those got me. Especially at the end, the guy had a circular saw in the department store. And that always creeped me out for some reason.
I think it's kind of interesting because that movie probably didn't do so well as like a horror kind of flick. I think the sequels to it ended up being more comedy oriented. Because I just remember I remember seeing one gremlin with lipstick, like the female one.
Yeah.
They hang from the chandelier and all that stuff. So.
Yeah, Well, they're watching Snow White in the first one. They're all watching the dwarfs, and they start singing the hi-ho song and throwing popcorn. And, it's
really
funny.
Remember. It was in
the I think the first movie was actually supposed to be a lot more violent and, like, rated, like, NC-17 or something, and they had to tone it down for the audiences they were trying to get, actually. So it was even a lot worse.
What did they tone it down to? Was it PG-13?
Probably R, because I think there's a lot of messed up.
I think it came in PG because they marketed it towards kids. Yeah, I had my Gremlins lunchbox and everything else, and I showed a clip in class where the mother is being attacked and stuffs the Gremlin in the blender and stuffs it in the microwave.
Is that at the time where rated R movies weren't rated R as how we see it now?
I think a lot of rated R movies from the 80s are probably PG-13.
Yeah.
I think it was a little earlier because it was like Jaws.
Jaws was 70.
Yeah, it was late 70s, like 78 or something like that. And Jaws is the one that retroactively they say would have been like PG-13, but at the time they didn't have it. So I think around the 80s we had the rating system. I just don't know if they were as sensitive as they might be now. Something to think about.
Well, I mean, it's run by the MPAA, Motion Picture Association of America, which is the industry in itself regulating itself, so the government doesn't have to step in.
Yeah.
And so the FCC is just, they're overrun. So they don't have enough people to sit there. They're just like the MPAA or whatever. Until we get complaints from parents and we have to go to court or something. But I guess... you know, PAA is just they purposely want to put movies in certain categories so either audiences can watch it or want to watch it. The appeal of the rated R, those who can't get into the movies or 18 or 17 and younger, it appeals to them.
I think it might have even been in your class, but I know I learned in my intro to film class that like the largest audience for movies that people gear towards is like 12-year-old boys or something. So mm-hmm. I think they do try to make it more mass appeal nowadays, especially like, I don't know, it was maybe, I don't think it was Transformers, but there was some movie where it was just like, yeah, this movie clearly like, I don't want to say dumbed down, but definitely like, okay, this is for mass appeal right now.
But then you have the purists who watch. When they did the sequel to Transformers and Bumblebee was in the cartoon from the 80s, he was a VW bug. And so the reason was because VW didn't give them the rights to be able to use the VW movie. They didn't want it being depicted in the way that Chevy doesn't care.
I was gonna say they got a ton of money from GM, didn't they, to do all American cars.
That's kind of interesting. I don't know why they wouldn't want that. I mean, that was a huge blockbuster movie. That's just free publicity.
They might have had their own reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I hope they had a good reason. But.
Yeah. The Americans fear the Germans all over again.
Yeah, the car looking weak.
I just wanted to drive a VW bus.
Just the wagon?
Yeah.
Lost?
The mystery machine. there is one that drives up and down 195. Somebody in the area owns one. And I used to run into them. And it was last year. Every time I would come to school, it was the mystery, like painted as the mystery machine.
Oh, that's awesome.
God, that's awesome.
Loved Scooby-Doo growing up. That was like my jam. I always loved that show. I never thought it was frightening or anything. I just always loved it. Scooby-Doo was like my hero growing up. I had like the plush doll and like.
Watched cartoons growing up. It wasn't until I got older where I started watching with my younger siblings.
I remember when like Finding Nemo was getting big and those kind of movies. My mom was like, "Oh, let's go see it," and I was like, "No, that's a kid's movie. I don't want to see that movie."
But I love it now, but now, when it came out,
exactly.
I did not watch it.
Yeah, me and my friends are like, "Oh, let's go see How to Train a Dragon." Like, you know, that kind of stuff. We're just like really into that stuff. I love that movie. Yeah.
Like, wait a minute.
It's awesome.
I watch cartoon movies now, but back when I was younger, I didn't like cartoons.
Yeah.
I
know.
Piaget would have. Freud would have.
I was telling about
horror movies.
Can't categorize me.
Yeah.
Not a typical child.
Which brings up the idea of individual differences and outliers, and bringing us back to research again.
Yeah, I think that's always tricky teaching it. Maybe you see it too, or you guys may see it in your classes. When we talk about the studies, I think people are trying to practice that skeptical scientist state of mind and. And I say, well, there could be other factors. There's all these individual difference factors. There's these personality things, socioeconomic status, families. And I think sometimes miss that some of the studies are accounting for that or they're controlling for that and then saying, even still, even if you control for parental influence, there's still this type of effect when you watch this type of media. And I wrestle with that as someone who teaches. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times when I see little reflections or talk to students about it, they say, well, there's this, 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 and this. And sometimes the studies have it. Or they've done random assignment to spread that out. And that's difficult. So I don't know. Do you guys have a take on that? Or have you had experience with that? Challenging?
Not
champions for individual difference?
Not in my 30s. And I think it's because most of them are probably just taking the first time. So the children need a question to be in the class with more specific target audience. 3,300 is just a broad overview of the research. I'm finding students are becoming more creative. semester ended. This research technique that they didn't use, your random assignment. Who was a psychiatrist. He studied the boys that were being sent to him. Not Walter.
It's kind of a scathing critique.
He wrote this entire book and with absolutely no research on the negative effects of comic books on boys. And he was a psychiatrist who was already helping really troubled boys. And so that was his sample size. His sample were these boys that he was treating, and then he didn't randomly pick comic books. He actually chose specific ones and ended up having these scathing critiques of certain comics, like Batman and Robin being perpetuating the homosexual agenda. Something about Superman being a Russian sympathizer. I forgot exactly what it was. He's in that book.
Yeah.
And I actually, the library has the book. I didn't have time to read it, but it was kind of interesting because what he ended up doing was publishing the book without any formal research outside of working with his patients. But then he, not only did he publish the book, he actually published articles in magazines read mostly by women, so then the women were fearful for their children and wouldn't allow them. He convinced them because he was a doctor, he was a psychologist. So transferring his knowledge of medication and psychology to media effects.
And he was credible enough, so everyone just believed it. That kind of reminds me of the SpongeBob study we talked about, because that was just such a big study that everyone just latched onto, but I don't necessarily still remember why it wasn't good. I remember it didn't compare it with, well, just everyone was just like, oh, a SpongeBob study. It shows that kids are becoming more, what was it, like sporadic and it was like ADD, that kind of a thing. And we found that it wasn't necessarily a good study, but I don't remember why. Do you remember why? Did you guys talk about it again? I remember they didn't they compared it with Caillou, and that was a bad thing. And they,
I remember something about they the did 9 11. Minutes of the episodes. SpongeBob episodes. I know they do them back to back. It's not just one episode of SpongeBob. Even when they play on regular television, you don't just get one. You get like a few.
It's a block of it.
And they're like 12 minutes. You just stop.
You just can't really compare the shows because they're so different that it's just like, yeah, kids going to be bored after watching Caillou because it's so low energy and the colors are like really, you know, blah. And it's not going to get you excited. Wasn't the control like drawing too? So wasn't it like, you know, how do you really compare
that? So if you didn't see this one, it got all this attention because it was SpongeBob. Man. It made it to the Today Show and USA Today and picked up, you know, they had really good PR. And exactly. It's a great idea for the study. And they were proposing that fast-paced programs like SpongeBob, fantastical elements, zany characters, lots of colors, lots of scene changes, that it would affect the logical processing of kids as compared to a slower paced program, less fantastical. So they picked Caillou, which if you talk to any parents who have small children and you mention Caillou, they universally hate Caillou.
The parents do.
So in the study, they found those differences. It looked like SpongeBob negatively affected, they called it executive functioning.
Yes.
But then they also acknowledge in the article, we picked these episodes. We didn't necessarily code all the things we think impact executive functioning. So our kind of takeaway was, well, it's a great idea. We need to see some more follow-ups just from two episodes. We can't really say SpongeBob is bad for kids.
I mean, if you're going to just base it off of pacing fantastical kind of stuff, then... And why don't they do a comparison between that and the current Sesame Street? I mean, they did those studies in the 70s when Sesame Street first came out, and they had all the pro-social effects of, it affected the kids all the way into high school, and they did the kids who watched Sesame Street as young kids ended up doing really well in high school. A good chunk of them went into college, which was great. But Sesame has changed so much since the 70s. It's really picked up pace. It's become a lot more commercial looking. Not to say that it is commercial, but they do have, they sell Elmo balls, and that's making a killing. But it'd be interesting to see how, you know, how SpongeBob might compare to something that everyone says is this great educational tool. But if you look at the pacing of Sesame Street today compared to even when in the 80s, I showed a clip to my students in class of Grover teaching us the differences between near and far. And it was literally like 2.5-3 minutes of Grover standing in front of the stream going, I'm near. And then he runs back and he goes, no, I'm far. And then he runs back, now I'm near. Do you get it? No? Oh, okay, I'll do it again. And he runs to the back, I'm far. And he runs back and forth and he does it a bunch of times. And by the end, he's like, near. And I'm laughing the entire time. My students laughed halfway through, but the second half, they were like, is this going to end?
Oh, I think
we get it.
Yeah.
And so to compare that to the way SpongeBob is pretty quick, too. It's very quick with the humor, and it's very adult-oriented.
Very adult-oriented.
Yeah. And they've done other studies where they looked at whether kids pick up on those things. And they do.
I know. I can't stand watching SpongeBob. My sister's 6, and she picks up on it. Mm-hmm. And it makes me angry that she picks up on it. And my father just sits there and he's like, oh, it's good for her. She's watching cartoons. And it makes inappropriate jokes. And well, like, how is that okay? It's Nickelodeon.
I'm a little concerned because my sister, for Christmas, she asked me to buy her 7-year-old son Call of Duty.
My sister plays those games. She plays Left 4 Dead. She's 6.
I called her and I said, you do realize what this game is, right? And you know the rating on it, and your son is 7. Same. She's like, I know.
Yeah. And they know. Okay. My dad plays with her. They go toe-to-toe. She gets mad if she can't kill him.
Well, I mean, the studies haven't really conclusively said that they necessarily cause aggression. There's no catharsis effect. That it's, you know, it causes arousal, but not necessarily long-term damage. They need to. But it's just kind of jarring for us to look at the younger generation and see them looking at all these violent things.
Oh, yeah.
And also in the 3300 classroom, in the violence chapter, I brought in a PS3 and I showed them. I had one student who had played it previously play it during the class. And while she was playing it, it was in the regular mode. But most of the students hadn't seen it since the days of Sega Genesis. The next generation after that was. And it was amazing to see the reactions of the students in the class because they remember it in a certain way. Yeah, there was blood splattered, but there's so much detail to the technology today, to the game in itself. Mm-hmm. The cuts that you can see in people's faces, their clothes are coming off.
Every drip of blood off their face. Yeah.
And so the students were familiar with the game, but not the amount of grotesqueness to it. And so they commented on it. This game has changed a lot since I
The only game that I grew up playing was Super Mario Brothers on the Nintendo. And that would make me really mad. Like, I would just pop out the cartridge and, like, smack the thing and kick it away. Mm-hmm. And that was anger, and it wasn't a violent game. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine now my sister 6 playing Left 4 Dead. She'll just sit there, and she'll be calm, and I can't see how she can play a game that has so much detail and so much excitement that she can stay calm. Same thing when she's watching SpongeBob, a show that has so much going on, but she'll just sit there and no expression or anything on her face. It's so weird.
You're making an argument for desensitization?
Perhaps.
Or, I mean, there could be individual differences in how she was raised. But at the same time, catharsis, too many studies have worked. But it's kind of interesting because people.
Catharsis is where you like purge it, right? Like you get this all out of the way online. Yeah.
So okay. Like you come home angry from work and you play. Like, I used to go bowling. Picture the pins as the people that you really dislike. I became a really good bowler. So,
That used to be my advice in T-ball when I try to hit the ball. Like, make sure it's homework. Make sure you hate the homework. Yeah, go on.
It's kind of interesting in whether the interactivity, I wonder if there is a difference in how your sister's heart rate differs, because outward expression and biological arousal or physiological arousal might be different. So if she's watching SpongeBob, then it's kind of like a passive medium. If you're not us, if you're not people who have taken classes on that you should pay attention to this stuff, whether her heart rate would get there would be more of a physiological arousal if she was playing the game versus if she was, because outward expression doesn't necessarily mean no arousal.
I think a lot of the violent video game stuff that I've read, you know, if they're doing it in a lab, there's 10 to 15 minutes of gameplay followed up by maybe a fake provoking situation or the measures afterwards. And by and large, they do find a short-term bump in aggression. Not someone's going to be a violent criminal, but more aggressive thoughts, feelings. If they do something like a proxy for behavior, they show higher scores for those that played the violent games. And I think there's a fair amount of the video game scholars that say, well, all right, there seems to be that pattern that seems to be pretty reliable across the studies. Is it this excitation transfer thing where because they're aroused, and then a lot of times these things will have a fake provoking thing where there's a fake contest, and if you lose, the person is zapping you. It's not really a person. It's just the way that the thing is set up. But because they're being provoked and their attention is diverted from, I just played a game, if they're still aroused from that violent game and they get provoked, they're more likely to have this intense, aggressive reaction. And I think some of the critics would say, well, okay, that arousal thing will dissipate in 5 to 10 minutes. So what is it really saying? You know, are you just doing an excitation transfer study, not necessarily a violence and aggression right. study? And then I think what we want is more longitudinal stuff. And actually, the guys that have been doing this for the 20 to 30 years at Bushman and Anderson, Bushman just released this week a longitudinal report, and some of the PR blurbs were going up in national media that they did do this repeated thing over the course of several days, and saw that the people playing the violent games kept going up. But it's interesting. There's the risk factors.
What do you mean by kept going up? They, like every time they went into the lab, they got aroused. Weren't there other studies that they did where they tested the same people over like an hour's time, and by the time the hour was up, they were back to regular heart rate?
I don't know if I read it. I know a lot of people have suspected that, you know, if you play for longer than 15 minutes, if you have a spike in arousal, what happens if you keep playing, right? Because in the lab, it's hard to get people to play for more than half an hour.
No. I mean that they played the game, tested them 5 minutes after there was, you know, the aggression there. But then an hour later, they tested them again. But I think they had different intervals. They did it 5 minutes. And then by the hour point, all of that aggression had kind of dissipated.
It may be. But Bushman and Anderson and them too would be worried.
I think it was a Bushman and
Anderson. They might be less worried about the short term and what happens if your sister is playing violent games every day. Violent games, consuming more violent media. Does it need to be a little more violent to be as arousing and fun for her? Is she learning this is how you respond to problems and challenges? So it doesn't necessarily mean she's going to go out and start hitting people with pipes, but does it mean...
She might.
I don't know.
Does it mean if, you know, if you're annoying her, maybe she yells at you to shut up, you know? And so it's more aggressive, not necessarily more violent.
Mm.
Or does she start hanging out with people who are more aggressive and pushy, and other timid people are less likely to hang out with her? Do you end up in this kind of spiral thing?
There was also a study that they cited in sports tests. I'm sorry, it's just on my mind because I just taught it. So.
Yeah, it's the most important book there is.
Yeah. The Effects Bible. Anyway.
It is a good book.
No, but he really was talking about how he was talking about. All right, go on then.
I was just gonna say, like, I've been a gamer my whole life, and I see the arguments for, like you were talking about your sister playing violence and like or seeing violent things, and you're afraid of it. And I think maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing. Like when I play a game like Call of Duty, and I played it. I mean, Call of Duty was to me Rainbow Six 3. When I played those violent games, I wasn't. Maybe this is good, maybe this is bad. I wasn't thinking I'm murdering a human and I'm getting 100 points. It was just like, this is my goal. I'm accomplishing my goal. And I think the aggression that everyone talks about, I see it more as competitiveness. Like, especially in close games when, like, you know you can win and it's just so fast-paced because you're trying to find the next guy to kill. And, like, yeah, you see it, it's literally killing, but it's just more, like, neutralizing. I don't know. So exactly. Especially if you lose a close game. Like, I've had my friends over, and, like, we'll throw controllers or, you know, and I hate when they do that because it breaks, but you know, that kind of a thing, and you just get really heated, and you go, shut up, I had him, like, you just get so hyped, but I don't think it's ever something real or tangible. I think it's just more like, if you just played a really good game of pool, or if you played, like, a really competitive basketball game, like, you see, like, Kobe Bryant getting really pissed off, like, 2 weeks ago, walking out on his team when they were down by 10, I don't remember who it was, but, like, all the media outlets were like, Kobe Bryant walking out on his team, what's going on here? I think it's similar to that in what the so I think it is excitation transfer. That's kind of where I was going with that.
I think as someone who grew up with those games and I had the Sega with Mortal Kombat in my bedroom, played it all the time.
Yeah.
I read the studies in, as an undergrad and was kind of like, no, I don't get into fights. This is garbage.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the more I read, the more I say, well, they're not saying that. It's more of a subtle psychological change over time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of hard to gauge, you know. Do I act a little more aggressively if somebody cuts me off in the car?
It's true.
Yeah.
You know? Because I play more of those games. The other last thing I wanted to tack on was, you know, in the lab, in these studies, they often focus on just one thing. And we kind of say media is good, media is bad. It's this black and white thing. You know, playing Call of Duty, Rainbow Six, whatever it may be, Left 4 Dead. You know, you're also learning problem solving. There's also a camaraderie thing if you're playing with friends or playing with your dad or playing over the internet with your cousins you never see. So it's not just black, white, this is good, this is bad. It could be, well, there's some aggression going on, but there's all these other positive things going on. It's kind of hard to weigh.
I definitely buy into that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm a different person because I play video games. I don't know. But there's speaking about the good things, I mean, there's also those the doctors nowadays that use the little cameras and the little like video game kind of controllers to like cut inside your body. And I mean, our video games making us more capable of those kind of things.
Maybe it that I read somebody was telling you that they compared like first or second year med students with regular game players, and the regular game players did just as well as the second year.
Precision.
I also heard about a guy who was saying that during an interview, there was a lot of people were interviewing for the same position, and during their conversation, the World of Warcraft came up, and he was talking about how I'm not familiar with World of Warcraft, so you're gonna have to help me out. That
I'm
he
a
was like
bit.
Like he was a supreme wizard level 60 whatever.
He
was really, really high level where he had his own team and he was leading a group of people into all these adventures. I sound like my parents did when I was younger and rolling my eyes. Oh my God, they have no clue. But it's true. And what he was saying was that the guy who he interviewed really liked that he had leadership skills. To be able to get to that level in World of Warcraft, that he was able to get a group of people together, and he ended up getting the job because of the skills that he gained. Building reputation.
But on the same note, can you come down from that? Come away from World of Warcraft when you need to? Can you step away from that?
So he's leading a team of World of Warcraft at work, but can he leave?
That's
instead of actually leading his team that's sitting right there staring at him, he's just.
If you're that vested into the game, I mean, have a problem coming out.
They did that awesome South Park parody. I don't know if you guys saw that, where it was just like Cartman and all the kids, they just get into the World of Warcraft phase, and they all just get like, it's just so into the game, they get huge, and they like eating pizza at the computer, and they're just yelling for their mothers to bring them more food. It's just so awesome. It's so perfect.
I think they won some awards for that one.
Yeah, it was perfect parody. Spot on.
And then piggybacking on Kiara's comment about kind of getting stuck in the game, I think there's a good book Jane McGonigal wrote, Reality is Broken, about that world being so attractive and the world of video games and the reward system and what it means for learning and trying to take all that and bring those aspects into education, businesses, real life to try to gamify. She writes about doing games for chores to get her kids and her husband and even her to take turns and how some businesses can do it. It's really interesting. She's got a great TED Talk. If you guys don't want to read anymore, just Google Jane McGonigal TED Talk, and she pitches it all really sharply.
Talk about how like airline pilots and they're doing driving tests just using games instead of actually putting people in danger.
Yeah.
Now when they have the robot, the hovercrafts, you know, invading.
The drones,
yeah, to test whether people can actually, you know, steer them. They do the games instead of actually putting the $1 million.
And there's also, I think it talks about in that book even, America's Army, is it the game that the National Guard makes in order to recruit people. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is some practical explanation there. Oh, that's true, but there is some practical, you know.
Yes.
All right, well, we're running low on time.
Oh,
I think we covered a lot of ground. I had fun. I think the best part was Chris impersonating Grover. I think that was
spot on.
Can you sign us off as Grover?
No. It comes out like Kermit. That's why
Kermit's
I can't do an Irish brogue because it turns out to be like a Jamaican accent. It's just awful.
I've always wondered why the fine line between the Irish and the Jamaican accent.
I found it. I turned from like an Irish leprechaun to Miss Cleo. Hi-ho.
Hi-ho. Hey. All right. So we're going on that. Cam Jam.
Nailing it.
Cam Jam number one is in the cast. So.
Dear Father.